This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart. Coming up, how the Pacific is moving to take more control over the spending of foreign donors' money on climate change mitigation and adaptation. Social media poised to play a new and significant role, perhaps, in Vanuatu's election campaign. And a tribute to Joe Rika, the face of cricket in Fiji, who has died aged just 32. Those stories to come, but first, the Minister for Petroleum and Energy in Papua New Guinea, Karenga Kua, has accused ExxonMobil of seeking to exploit his country's economic frailty following the collapse of talks over the development of the Pinyang gas field in Western Province. Mr. Kua says the state has pulled out of the negotiations, but the multinational oil and gas corporation could yet be granted a third petroleum development license by the Petroleum Advisory Board. And if the independent body opts to grant Exxon's application, then Mr. Kua says the government could be compelled to reach a deal. But as things stand, unless Exxon comes back with a proposal that meets PNG's expectations, he says there will be no agreement.
The entirety of the negotiations has been a farce. There was no chance of an agreement ever being reached anyway. Parties need to make sure they are coming in prepared to do a deal in good faith. Exxon came in to exploit our weak economic circumstances. How could we have ever struck a deal with that kind of mindset? It was not possible. And it took 3 months to prove that out. So we have down tools. And the only way it can go forward is if somebody comes up and is prepared to talk to the government on the terms that the government prefers.
So does that mean that Exxon are now out of negotiation, or are you prepared to keep talking to them if they come back with an improved offer?
Well, the negotiations that were carried out were a parallel exercise to see if a gas agreement can be signed off. But that failed, and now I don't know. Somewhere along the way, the Petroleum Advisory Board will resume to determine the fate of that application. There's two ways that can go. One is the application will be granted, in which case we have to find a way to strike an agreement so that the project can go ahead. The other way is that Petroleum Advisory Board might reject the application. If they do, then all of Exxon's residual interests are extinguished. So the resource will be without a licensee and back to the drawing board for the state and to open up conversation with any other interested party.
But from the government's point of view, are you willing to continue to negotiate with Exxon if the advisory board says yes?
Negotiations with Exxon is at an end.
So are you therefore concerned that this project, which of course is of vital importance to Papua New Guinea, could fall over?
We are concerned that the project negotiations have collapsed, but we are used to that kind of roller coaster and we will ride our way through.
Is this partly to do with the fact that perhaps the Marape government is somewhat tougher than perhaps the O'Neill and previous governments were on these sorts of negotiations?
I think you may be right on that score, because if we just stand up and pick up and figure on what the state total take should be, that'll be arbitrary. But the best guide is to look at existing practices within the neighborhood where ExxonMobil has extensive operations. And you look at the kind of parameters in which ExxonMobil is prepared to operate. You look at those as benchmarks. And then you come to the negotiating table and you say, Exxon, in this country, these are the terms of your operations. In this country, such and such. In this country, such and such. Now, when you look at that and you compare it to Papua New Guinea, the total state take is far, far lower than what offering for those other countries. So why don't you bring it up so that there's parity? That was all that the state was asking for. And Exxon felt obligated to stick to their position that Papua New Guinea is not entitled to any more than what they feel, which is the lowest in comparison to most of the precedents that exist in the neighborhood.
Would you say, therefore, that perhaps Exxon to some degree have taken Papua New Guinea for granted?
Well, more than that, I think they've come into it with complete bad faith and prepared to take advantage, knowing our vulnerabilities and our economic weaknesses. I think they came in with the view to exploit it. Why is it that you are able to give a better deal in all other countries in Southeast Asia, but you cannot extend that to Papua New Guinea?
Over and above everything else, though, are you personally optimistic? Is the government optimistic that a deal can be done with someone, and presumably sooner the better?
This exercise has restored the dignity and pride of our sovereign nation. And that means a lot more to us. money and profits if they materialize fair and good. But listen, even the United Nations categorizes Papua New Guinea as an impoverished nation. This thing is not going to make our circumstance any worse. So we are comfortable. Important thing is, what is our heart's condition? We are at peace.
Does that mean that you're prepared as a government to let this whole deal go, to leave the gas in the ground if you can't get the deal that is favorable to Papua New Guinea?
We're happy to wait.
Indefinitely?
Well, that's the part that I'm not commenting, but we're happy to wait for a few weeks, months, years. We are already where we are without this project coming on stream, and we are comfortable with where we are. If it happens, it happens. But it's got to be on our terms. We're going to be insisting upon it. We're watching the world. The landscape in Papua New Guinea has changed. We now have a lot of educated people, and we are exporting them into the international labor market. And they are advising and they are performing at very professional levels all around the world. So the Papua New Guinea we have now is not the Papua New Guinea that we had 10 years, 15 years, 20 years ago. So all these educated people are advising us as we move forward on this particular issue. And they have no fear. They support the government in exactly what it's doing. We are taking a position based on proper advice from our own people. It's their country. That's the way they want us to run it. That's the way we'll run it for them.
That's the Minister for Petroleum and Energy in Papua New Guinea, Karenga Kua. And one of Exxon's partners, Oil Search, has responded to Mr. Kua's claims, with outgoing Managing Director Peter Botten saying the terms the PNG government was seeking would have made the project uninvestable and unbankable. Governments in the Pacific are taking steps to exert greater control over the way money targeting climate change mitigation and adaptation is managed. As Catherine Grau reports, they're on a mission to create a unique pot of money that would still come from donor partners, but decisions over how it would be used will be made at local level.
Pacific people know well just how vulnerable they are to the projected impacts of climate change. Crystal Pratt is the Deputy Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum Secretariat.
We are finding that they are becoming a lot more intense and they're becoming a lot more regular. They are resulting in increased economic costs and impacts to our countries, but also impacting our communities who are very much at the front line.
There is money available for Pacific countries to help build their climate resilience, but
there are a plethora, if you like, or a multiplicity of funds. There's the Green Climate Fund, the GEF. What we have found is that there is a gap.
These are the big programs, the multilateral development banks. They don't focus on community level. They like big, chunky public infrastructure projects.
That's Garth Henderson, the head of the Cook Islands Finance Department.
In the Pacific, there was a degree of frustration that many pledges, much money promised, but the money wasn't actually hitting the ground and creating outcomes. A project in country should not happen unless it's part of the national planning and is captured in the budget. These projects that operate parallel outside government systems are often the projects that overlap, duplicate, fail. That's happening now. It's a reality that we're trying to clean up.
So he's been in Australia meeting with a range of people to get them on board the new Pacific Climate Facility, a Pacific government idea that's been coordinated by PIF.
We are getting very positive feedback. Development partners are in the space for their own interest as well as ours.
They're looking to raise $1.5 billion at a major pledging event in May in the United States. But then they would just rely on the interest that money earns. The interest would actually be what's used to fund small community projects from early next year.
It might be tropical cyclone shelters. You might have community halls in place. It means getting in there and providing some finance to strengthen community halls to tropical cyclone category 5 or 6. There's warning systems, communication systems, there's transport networks, all small scale, between 50 to 200,000 that current facilities do not address.
But another small community grants program here in Australia has recently run into trouble.
There are calls for senior federal minister Bridget McKenzie to step down, accused of running a $100 million slush fund targeting marginal seats.
After weeks of intense scrutiny, Australia's former sports minister Bridget McKenzie quit cabinet over her role in the so-called sports rorts affair. It came after a scathing audit report found that she had used a $100 million program to funnel money into marginal seats ahead of last year's national election here in Australia. The irony of the situation is not lost on Garth Henderson, who admits their system could be used by governments to their own political advantage, but he says they'll put protections in place.
I've been following that story myself. I find it ironic that when development partners come and introduce programs into our country, they're very insistent that we have this, transparency, don't politicize the issue. I find it ironic that when I come here, I pick up the newspaper and I see the very thing that they're demanding we don't do is actually happening here. So I find that funny. But no, I'm pretty confident that smaller countries, more oversight, more transparency, good complaints channel will minimise that. But there's always a risk of that happening, I admit.
Garth Henderson, head of Cook Islands Finance Department, and the reporter there was Catherine Grau. I'm Richard Hewitt, and you're listening to Pacific Review. Fresh analysis of last year's national election in Solomon Islands has found that young people say there's still more to be done to ensure their voice is heard. But as Evan Masuka reports, the analysts have also uncovered a new trend, with around 12% of the voter population swapping electorates ahead of polling day.
Solomon Islands' first election since the departure of the Australian-led Regional Assistance Mission was peaceful, well-run, with an 86% voter turnout. But election observers from the Australian National University have raised concerns about cross-border voting. ANU's team leader, James Batley, says it's a new phenomenon that's seen 1 in 8 voters switch constituency.
People said this to our observers. They were on the hunt for a Member of Parliament who would provide them with greater benefits than the previous constituency where they were enrolled.
The role of constituency funds, government grants given to MPs prior to the election, were also highlighted over its possible influence on voter turnout. So too the role of women in politics. Only 2 women were elected into the 50-member House.
About 3/4 of people told us that they thought there should be more women in Parliament, but only about half said that they'd be prepared to vote for a woman to go into Parliament. So that's an interesting divergence there. When it comes down to it, feel still constrained about voting for women candidates. And that's obviously an area where civil society, as well as government and international organisations, can pay some attention to in the coming period.
Rewin Taonia is a strong supporter for getting more women into politics.
Even though I advocate for women to, to become members of parliament, but I think there is still a need for more support, more awareness around equal participation.
In a country where 3/4 of the population are under the age of 34, young people have a strong political voice. It's a view shared by Regina Lepping, a young filmmaker and youth advocate.
I feel like I'm not left out. Mm. I'm part of the conversation. I'm part of my community, my constituency, even though I do not vote for that person.
She says while young people may hold numerical strength at the ballot box, their concerns are not yet being dealt with as a group.
Youth is a big issue. The youth unemployment rate is still a big issue, and not much has been done about that yet.
Harry James Olikwailafa is the president of the Honiara Youth Council. He says young people are still yet to find their collective voice.
The influence from family, tribal members, and also friends still a number one challenge for young people to, have a free conscience to vote for their candidate, their suitable candidate.
Rewin Taonia says young people need to use their political power to focus on the best outcome for their future.
We need to think beyond what we have now and try to reflect, think about what we really want for ourselves and also for our communities and country.
Rewin Taonia, ending that report from Evan Wasuka. Now, a general election in Vanuatu is just over 6 weeks away, and the battle for the hearts and minds of voters is set to intensify. But rather than follow the traditional pathway of battling to make an impact on the hustings, 2 internet producers are offering candidates an alternative strategy, and it's one that could benefit female candidates in particular. Internet services in Vanuatu are getting better, and with the advent of fibre optics, it's estimated that 98% of the population has internet access now, and therefore access to social media as well. Based on that fact, internet producer Milroy Cainton says he and his partner Harrison Selman are offering election candidates the chance to produce their own campaign video that will be posted on the Vanuatu Dialogue Live site, GE 2020.
We take on anybody, all the major parties like Vanuatu Party, RMC, National United Party, Leaders Party, and TJP party, even independent candidates can contact us and we can put them on the show. And we're going to develop questions in relevance to their political party platforms or policies.
Mr. Caton says he's on a mission to educate and inform voters. But while some candidates are showing an interest, only one has been prepared to pay the required fee so far.
We would like all the political candidates to pay some form of cost. So it's around 50,000 VATU, which is equivalent to around $500. That would cover the video shooting, cover the cost of post-production, and then also cover the cost of social media promotion and also engagement.
Social media commentator and presenter of the YouTube technology show Tech Talk, Anthea Arnambat, says in terms of the impact a social media campaign could have, $500 could be money well spent.
Once they upload it, your messaging is out there 24/7. Anytime, any place, people can just tune in and listen to what you have to offer. When you're just doing campaigns in particular communities, the messaging just reaches the crowd that's around you, and that's it.
And for female candidates, Ms. Arnambat argues that a social media campaign could prove to be much more effective than the traditional ways, where women can often encounter stigma and aggression.
I think social media is a place where people, they're not defensive. They're not in a defensive mode. They're just receptive to whatever it is that they're looking at and they're seeing or they're listening to on Facebook. So I think it's a great tool for women to start getting rid of some of that stigma, why people should rally up behind them to become general election candidates.
If you are running, we're going to help you. And we would put our best into promoting female candidates. We would love to see female candidates. I've been doing several posts for the fact that we should have one reserve seat for female politician in the parliament. And if a female candidate comes forward, we would be very, very happy to provide them a good communication tool. And we would maximize our engagement on social media to promote them. But if they do not come forward, we will go and approach them and say, look, we are providing an avenue. I think you should use it.
But the immediate question for Milroy Cainton is why candidates right now at least appear to be reluctant to take the social media pathway.
They might be questioning, why should we go and shoot the video and spend $500 when we do not know if it's going to be popular? They want to have the return of investment on it, and they are not too sure of it. I think because of the low level of digital literacy and the low level understanding of the fact that social media can create a huge impact on their campaign.
Should enough candidates eventually come forward, Anthea Arnambat says social media campaigning could have another important effect by reaching out to Vanuatu's young voters.
It's a tool that they're very much using. And then to bring in something like this where maybe these young people don't see the importance of voting, perhaps Facebook would be a way that we can start educating them that, no, you need to vote. You need to exercise that right.
As well as election candidates, the GE 2020 producers also plan to feature experts on the site, with the first two videos focusing on finance and health. And from there, the hope is momentum will build.
We're going to roll out those two videos. And they're going to point out issues in the financial sector and health issues. And from there, when it creates interest, then we're going to roll out the first political candidate. And from there, I think it will challenge other candidates to come forward and use the service.
Milroy Cainton, co-producer of the GE 2020 social media site for Vanuatu election candidates. And you're listening to Pacific Review. The prospects of Pope Francis visiting Papua New Guinea later this year appear to be growing in light of recent developments in neighbouring Indonesia. One of the country's senior Muslim leaders recently returned from the Vatican, saying the Pope told him he has plans to visit Indonesia, PNG and Timor-Leste in September. And now it's been confirmed that in line with protocol, the Indonesian government have put in an official invitation to the pontiff. An invitation from Papua New Guinea is long-standing, and the Bishop of Mendi, Don Lippitt, says there is rising excitement in the country about a papal visit, but as yet, nothing official.
Under Prime Minister Peter O'Neill, the invitation went to Rome for a visit. We have read the information about the Indonesians and have heard also that East Timor might be included if a visit like that were to eventuate. But we have no confirmation from Rome or from the Vatican that that will take place. We're certainly excited and would hope that it would. I guess that's really all I could say, that the official invitation went forth. It was not withdrawn by the Marape administration, so that it was still in effect. at this stage is something that we are hoping for, and we hope we know soon because it would take a heck of a lot of preparation.
As you suggest, rumors and a lot of guesswork at the moment, but the fact that the original story in Indonesia emanated from a meeting between one of the top Islamic clerics there who spoke to the Pope directly at the Vatican, now a few days later the Indonesian government puts in the official invitation, that would tend to suggest that there is some substance to this.
Certainly, if the Pope travels, he's 80 years old or something right now, so he's not going to just go to one place. He'll try to hit a few places. And certainly his priority seems to have been the margins. From his writings and his own speaking, he does seem to favor the margins of the world. Also, another thing is that he named a cardinal here in Papua New Guinea. We have Cardinal John Ribot, the Archbishop of Port Moresby. So showing that he has a predilection for the marginal places. And recently we were in Kimbe for the installation of a new bishop, and we were talking to each other about the same issue, but there's been no full confirmation of a papal visit.
If a visit were to go ahead, and the suggestion is it would be September, how much organization would it take in PNG, and who would be responsible for that?
Well, it would certainly be a coordinated thing. The church would have to go ahead with all kinds of plans as far as venues and events and who he would meet, those kinds of things. And that's a lot of planning. And then the organization of the events themselves. But then the whole other side of it is the organization the state would have to provide in terms of security and those kinds of logistics. I have no doubt that Papua New Guinea could do that. We hosted the APEC meeting without any major incident, with some great help, of course, from Australia and other places. But I have no doubt that, this could be pulled together. But usually it takes time. So I'm hoping that if this is actually going to happen, that we get some solid information directly from the Vatican as soon as possible.
What would it mean to you personally to welcome the Pope into the country which you serve?
Well, it would be wonderful. I've had the chance to meet him on a visit to Rome in the past. He's a wonderful person. I think he would be very encouraging to our people who have many challenges in their lives, and it would show a direct and personal concern for them. Papua New Guinea is predominantly a Christian country. Catholic Church is a major part of that. And I think he would come with an encouraging message and perhaps a challenging one too. So I think it would be a great shot in the arm for the church here and for the country as well.
That's the Catholic Bishop of Mendi in the Papua New Guinea Highlands, Don Lippert. And finally, the Pacific cricket community is in mourning following the shock news that the face of the sport in Fiji, Joe Rika, has died at the age of just 32 after suffering an asthma attack during a training session. Joe had a huge impact on raising the profile of cricket in Fiji, first as a player and then as high-performance manager. He had big plans to develop the game further, but sadly, now the chief executive of Cricket Fiji, Alex Conrotta, says Joe won't be around to see them come to fruition.
Major loss to cricket in Fiji and cricket in the Pacific as well. Joe was just really one of a kind. Joe actually put cricket on the map amongst the top four sports in Fiji. For many years, he's been the face of cricket Fiji and the face of cricket in Fiji. We've had CEOs, but whenever you talk to someone at grassroots level about cricket, the name they come up first with is Joe Rika. We know Joe. His record speaks for himself. You can find it all over the web. But someone is, 13 years old, making his debut in the under-19s, 17 into the national team, not only an all-round great cricketer, but just an all-round beautiful human being.
Do you have a highlight performance from his cricketing career that stands out for you?
When he was under-19, he scored 257 runs off about 140 balls against Japan. And that record's yet to be beaten by not just our under-19s, but our national team as well. But one thing I know that Joe was really proud of, I think the highlight of his legacy, is that he had grouped together a bunch of boys when they were under-15s, and he groomed them, mentored them, and coached them all the way through to under-19s when they actually qualified for the World Cup. First time any team from Fiji. Fiji went in as underdogs. Joe had spent close to 4 years with his boys. They got smashed in the World Cup, but they walked out still very proud of themselves. And, Joe never stopped talking about that bunch of boys, most of whom have made the national team and are still playing. So despite his own records, the unbeaten records in cricket, he still talks a lot about these bunch of boys that represented Fiji to the World Cup.
We've seen messages on social media about Joe's death. What has the response from the Pacific cricket community been like?
Everyone's been calling these last couple of days, and the East Asia Pacific countries, we've had a lot of them call in. The president for Vanuatu Cricket called directly and expressed his condolences, but also asked that we put in a wreath on behalf of Vanuatu cricket, and gave a few words to put on a card, Samoa as well. And so the Pacific are feeling his loss as well. Joe was an advocate for Pacific success at World Cup level. And I don't think anyone in Fiji celebrated more and was happier more than Joe when Papua New Guinea qualified for the World Cup. He called everybody he knew just to say how happy he was.
Alex Konrata, CEO of Cricket Fiji, speaking there to Talia Olatia and paying tribute to former captain and high-performance manager Joe Rika. A sad note on which to end this edition of Pacific Review. I'm Richard Ewart. Thank you very much for listening.